This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents Second Skin, written by Kristen White, performed by Ellen Archer.
Dedication. For my best friend, Izzy. Prologue. From the transcript of Aaron Keefe's hypnotic regression, recorded by Takashi Matsui on August 3rd, 2020. I want you to picture a door in your mind. It can be any kind of door, but I want you to really see it, feel it. Take notice of the details, what the door is made of, the shape of the handle. Can you see the door, Aaron?
Yes.
What kind of door is it?
It's like the front door of our apartment. Brown and wooden, with a little peephole in the front. Only the peephole is low enough so I can look through it.
Perfect. As I count down from 10, I want you to imagine you're reaching for the door handle, turning the handle, opening the door. When I reach 0, the door will open. Do you understand?
Yes.
10, 9, 8. You're reaching for the handle. 7, 6, 5, 4. You're turning it. 3, 2, 1. You're opening the door. 0. The door's open. Now step through the door, Aaron.
Where does it go?
Into your own mind. But there's no need to be afraid, remember? My voice travels with you wherever you go. And we're going to leave the door open so you can come back anytime.
Okay. I'm stepping through.
Good girl. On the other side of the door is a beach. The sand is white as snow. The sky is clear and blue. You can hear the water lapping gently against the shore. When you look to your left, you'll see that the coastline stretches on and on, way off into the distance. Can you see it?
Yes.
That's your future, Aaron.
My future?
That's right. Your future. Unwritten and unexplored. Now, I want you to turn to your right. You'll see a blanket of thick white mist, so dense you can hardly see the beach. Do you see it?
Yes.
That's your past. The mist is all your memories. Not just from when you were little, but before then. Walk into the mist, Aaron. Into the past. Into the life you lived before. Before you were Aaron.
I'm scared.
There's nothing that can hurt you in there. Now walk into the mist. Walk into the mist and tell me what you see.
I don't see anything. Everything is just white. The fog is too thick. I can't even see my feet anymore.
But your feet are still there. Keep walking.
I think I see something. Up ahead. Floating in the mist. I see.
What, Aaron? What do you see?
Eyes. Red eyes. There's something in here with me. It's watching me.
Chapter 1. Stan. On a clear afternoon in June, Stan Weir sat behind the wheel of his Subaru Forester, parked outside West Milden Junior High, waiting to pick his daughter up from school. Temperatures were in the high 70s. The sky was endless and blue. A Beyoncé song was playing on the radio. Life was good. Stan was happy. But he was about to learn one of life's great tragedies. We don't know we're living in the good old days until the good old days are gone. It was the last day before school broke for the summer, so when the bell rang, students spilled into the parking lot like animals escaping the zoo. Stan found Lucy's face in the crowd. She was easy to spot. Tall for her age, she towered above the rest of her classmates, long-limbed and skinny. She was wearing her trademark mariner's cap, ponytail stuffed through the loop in the back, swishing back and forth with each long stride. She saw him and grinned. It was a frazzled, energetic grin, the kind of grin a marathon runner flashes as they cross the finish line. Or a 12-year-old girl with a virtual lifetime of sunny days stretched out ahead of her. She reached the car and fell into the passenger seat. 10 weeks, she said, stepping out of her Chuck Taylors and sticking her feet up on the dash, something she wasn't allowed to do in her mother's Merc. But there were no rules in the Forester. I don't have to come back here for 10 weeks. Oh, and Ms. Vaughn retired today, so I never have to see her again in my life. They played a slideshow about her in assembly this morning. She was frowning in every single photo. It was pretty hilarious.
Wow. I remember Ms. Vaughn from when I went to school here, Stan said. She was ancient then.
The rumor is she's a vampire who feeds on the blood of her students. Did you ever see her go outside in the sunlight? He thought it over.
Come to think of it.
Told you, Lucy said. He started the engine and took care backing out. The parking lot was bustling. Parents edged toward the pickup point. Big yellow buses idled with their doors slung open, quickly filling up with kids. He pulled out onto Beetle Street and started toward home. Lucy didn't look back over her shoulder once. When the school was behind them, she rolled down the window and let her hand swim in the breeze. Milden had an artsy bohemian vibe. The streets were lined with coffee houses, cozy bars, quirky bookstores, and bizarre outdoor sculptures. A particular favorite of Lucy's was the Milden Troll, a giant, nightmarish installation built beneath Prospect Bridge. Stan was 39 then.
Do me a favor and press play on the CD player, he said.
Lucy leaned forward without much thought and did as she was told. Her face lit up when Work Song, the very first track on the Les Miserables soundtrack, came blaring out of the speakers.
Have you ever wondered what it would be like to see Les Mis live?
He asked. With a smirk, she said, We did see it live, remember? At the community center? The cast were all about 50. The guy playing Gavroche was like a grown man. It was weird.
That was amateur theater, he told her. That doesn't count. I'm talking about Broadway. Broadway, baby!
He let the clue dangle in the air for a moment. Lucy turned to him with a pinched, curious expression. Wait, are you saying...
Glove compartment.
No way, she whispered. She brought her feet down from the dash and opened the glove compartment slowly, as if waiting for something to leap out at her. When it didn't, she reached inside and found the white envelope Stan had left there for her. Her name was printed in neat block letters on the front. Dad, if you're messing with me, I swear to God.
Just open it.
She tore it open. Inside were 3 crisp tickets to see Les Miserables on Broadway. Lucy was silent for a moment as she stared down at them, feeling the weight in her hands, gazing down with wide eyes, as if regarding a priceless artifact. Then she screamed. If the windows hadn't been rolled down all the way, Stan's eardrums might have burst. People on the street turned with panicked faces as they drove by.
We leave for New York tomorrow, he said. Road trip.
Road trip? Isn't New York like 3,000 miles away?
Well, yeah, we're not actually driving, but air trip doesn't have the same ring to it.
Dad, I... she stammered. Thank you. Tears welled in her eyes. They were happy tears. In the months and years to come, after all the dark things, Stan would think back to this moment and want to live in it. It would become a snapshot of the before times. A color photo, fading and precious. Lucy in the passenger seat, wet-eyed and smiling. Where are we sitting? She asked.
Stalls, baby, he told her. Close enough to see the actor spit.
Her hands balled into tight little fists, and she punched the air with them, over and over and over. Then she froze suddenly and said, Hold up. There are 3 tickets here. Who's the 3rd one for?
Take a wild guess.
Mom's coming?
You think she'd miss it?
Can she take that much time off work?
She'll have to make a few calls while we're away, and She might need to head back one or two days early, but Luce, she wouldn't miss it.
Stan couldn't wait to get away. His wife had made partner at a successful and ruthless law firm. She specialized in litigations and bringing home the bacon. Stan was a stay-at-home dad, but lately it seemed a lot more like stay-at-home than dad. Lucy was 12 now, and about as low maintenance as they came. She was also gone close to 8 hours a day, leaving him to shuffle around the house like a ghost. He usually spent the mornings clearing breakfast and tidying up. Then he'd drink coffee and look up dinner recipes online for a while and watch Bigfoot videos on YouTube. After lunch, usually a simple sandwich or pot noodle, he'd drive over to the community markets in Columbia City to pick up whatever groceries they needed to make dinner. At 4, he'd fetch Lucy from school and chop vegetables and meat while she did her homework at the kitchen counter. Sometimes, if it wasn't math or biology, Lucy struggled to concentrate when using the right half of her brain. They'd listen to records while they worked. Joanne got home around 8. Stan liked his simple life, but worried about how it would change when Lucy was old enough to go off to college. It would happen in a blink of an eye. That's what everyone said. Then Stan would be making dinners for 2. It made him picture a broken-down old car being towed off to the scrapyard. Maybe he'd take some DIY classes at the local community college, or finally write the horror novel that had been thumping around his head for years. As it turned out, it wasn't something he'd need to worry about. They'd turned right onto Finland Avenue just as Bishop Mariel was rescuing Jean Valjean from the police. He rolled up the volume and started singing along. Lucy laughed and joined in. They were still singing like that, at the top of their lungs, father and daughter, when reality shifted. That's the only way he could describe it later, when he would be asked over and over and over, what happened? Reality shifted. His vision blurred. A wave of confusion swept quickly into his mind. Time slowed down, as if he'd slipped out of sync with the world around him. His left hand cramped against the wheel. His head jerked forward. His foot, acting autonomously from the body now, pressed down hard on the gas. With his free hand, the one that worked, he reached for Lucy, first groping air, then clamping down on her knee. Hot urine gushed suddenly and violently down his leg. Then, the darkness took him. Stan had his first seizure when he was 8 years old. He'd been at Nikki Healy's birthday party, sitting at a picnic table in a big backyard somewhere in suburban Seattle, where he grew up. There were at least a dozen other children his age there, standing shoulder to shoulder beside him or sitting cross-legged in the freshly cut grass, all staring, gaping, mesmerized by the same thing, a clown in a bright red floppy suit. The clown danced from one foot to the other, pulling out all the classics, the never-ending handkerchief, the water-squirting flower, juggling balls that fell one at a time against his head. He was tying his third balloon animal, a giraffe, when it began to happen. It had been an overcast day, but suddenly the yard became dazzlingly bright. The blues, reds, greens, and yellows on the clown's multicolored bow tie started to pulse in time with Stan's heart. He didn't feel scared, but he felt confused, as if he'd just stepped out of this reality and into one that lay directly next to it. He turned slowly toward the picnic table. There was just a single piece of Nikki's chocolate birthday cake left, but it didn't look like cake now. It looked like an object hovering in a layer of space, like something in one of the 3D movies he'd seen at Disneyland the previous summer. He followed a drip of condensation as it slunk down the pitcher of Mrs. Healy's homemade lemonade. It moved impossibly slowly. There was an ice bucket filled with Pepsi bottles next to the pitcher. The melting ice glistened brightly, like dozens of floating eyes. Feeling uneasy now, he looked beyond the picnic table to where the adults were standing in the shade of the back porch, watching over the kids with varying degrees of interest, drinking Pabst and wine spritzers. As he stared up at them, their faces blurred and bled together, like a hand sweeping through a fresh oil painting. When he turned back to the party, he was dimly aware, as much as he could be aware of anything, that everyone had stopped what they were doing and were now staring directly at him. Even the clown, who hadn't stopped smiling since marching in on his oversized shoes, now had a look of grave concern on his face.
"You all right, kid?"
he asked, not in his high-pitched clown voice, but in a nervous, everyday voice.
"Kid, can you hear me? I think we might need some help over here."
There was movement, hurried footsteps, panicked voices, but they were far away now. Stan began to tremble and shake. As he pitched forward into the picnic table, he pictured the paint shaker in the hardware store where his dad used to work. Arms by his side, he toppled the ice bucket, sent Pepsi bottles flying, and slumped face first into the grass. Soothing darkness had come, for a while. When he regained consciousness, the clown was jamming one white-gloved hand into his mouth, trying to keep him from swallowing his tongue. Stan was officially diagnosed with epilepsy 4 weeks later. Soon after that, he started having regular seizures. They were at their most frequent and terrifying when he hit puberty. Medication helped, but the side effects, nausea, weight gain, depression, speech problems, drowsiness, short-term memory loss, etc., 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 were often worse than the disease itself. He didn't date much because he was scared of having a brain event in front of whatever girl he was crushing on. He didn't drink at parties because it increased the likelihood of having a seizure. A normal teenage life passed him by. When he thought about his childhood, he pictured a spooked child hiding beneath the covers, but the monster he was hiding from was under there with him. Still, slowly and steadily, that little boy learned to keep the monster at bay. He found the right dosage of Tegretol, learned how to meditate, and switched to a strictly ketogenic diet. The seizures slowed and, for the most part, stopped entirely. By the time he left for college, he'd stopped being defined by his epilepsy. This new sense of freedom allowed him to find two things at the University of Washington: himself and Joanne. Joanne was folksy and beautiful. She wore woolen hats, bleached her hair blonde, and played Leonard Cohen songs on the guitar. Somehow, against all the odds, she fell for Stan, a gangly, passive kid from the suburbs. He warned her about his epilepsy, but in all their years of courtship and eventually marriage, she never once witnessed him fit. It didn't become an issue until Joanne fell pregnant with Lucy. Stress and sleep deprivation can trigger a seizure, so with a new baby on the way, certain precautions needed to be taken. Their OBGYN gave them a list of cautionary measures as long as Stan's arm, which they followed to the letter. When feeding the new baby, he had to stay low to the ground. When bathing her, Joanne would need to be in the room, just in case. He avoided carrying the baby if they were alone. Safety pins were a big no-no for obvious reasons. He even tied a length of cord to the stroller and the other end around his waist, so if he fitted mid-walk, the baby wouldn't roll into traffic. He spent the first 3 years of Lucy's childhood in a state of fear. But as time passed without incident, he began to hope, then believe, that his fitting days were behind him. Had becoming a father somehow cured him? His fears faded, and eventually he was able to put them in a box at the back of his mind and forgot about them. Until that clear afternoon in June. The Forester swerved across a lane of traffic and swept into the intersection of Weber and Tope Street. It was clipped by a shiny gold Nissan Titan, spun backwards in a wide arc, then sheared through one side of a glass bus shelter. Mercifully, the shelter was empty. The 359 downtown bus, known for running late, had arrived on time that day. Had the accident occurred just 4 minutes earlier, the Subaru would have plowed through whoever was unlucky enough to be waiting there. Instead, the car slid across the curb and flattened a wooden barrier that separated the sidewalk from a steep, grassy embankment on the other side. It careened down the embankment, flipping once, then landed roof first in the concrete channel below. Stan would have no memory of any of this. He had to read about it later in the police report. He wasn't really in the car now. His body was present, jerking limply against the seatbelt, but his mind was someplace warm and dry and dark and far away. If he had been conscious, he would have heard the frightened screams of onlookers, blaring horns and screeching brakes. He would have smelt burnt rubber, would have felt the explosion of safety glass as the front windshield folded in around them, the sharp thud as the airbag burst open against his face. He would have heard Lucy, sweet Lucy, utter a short, tight scream before all the air was sucked from her lungs.
Beep, beep, beep.
Holy fucking shit, Joanne said. Look what I made. A long time before the accident, Stan and Joanne were in the nursery room at Milden Private Hospital, surrounded by pastel shades of blue and pink and green. Joanne, looking ragged and delighted, was slouched on a sofa, holding their new baby in her arms. Lucy was one day old. Somewhere, a heart monitor chirped. I made this little head, Joanne said, gently poking her tiny new daughter. I made these little cheeks, these little eyeballs, and oh my God, these little fingernails. Leonardo da Vinci never made anything this beautiful.
You had a little help from me, Stan said.
Oh, please. All you did was pour a little oil on the pan. I'm the one who made dinner. Stan had laughed at that, a little too loudly. Lucy stirred and cooed in Joanne's arms.
Quit bogarting her, he said. I want a turn.
Joanne gave Lucy to Stan, and they sat shoulder to shoulder on the sofa, staring at her.
Beep, beep, beep.
Now that the baby's out, have I lost my pregnancy glow? Joanne asked.
If by pregnancy glow you mean that sheen of sweat on your forehead, then no. How's your perineum, by the way?
It's fine, weirdo.
Have you been doing rice?
What the hell is rice?
Rest, ice, compression, and elevation? Did you listen to anything the midwife told us?
I couldn't stop staring at her mustache, Joanne said. Seriously, why don't her friends tell her to wax that thing? She lay her head on his shoulder. The three of them there, together, felt like home.
Beep, beep, beep.
When I was pregnant, I was so scared I wouldn't be, you know, maternal, she said. My mom loved her cats more than she ever loved me, and I was worried I'd be the same. But I feel so bonded to her, Stan, and to you.
I love you, he told her.
I love you too, she said. Then, looking down at their new baby girl, and we both love you, Squirt.
Beep, beep, beep.
Stan woke, pulled from the memory like the twang of a bungee cord. He tried to sit up, but a rush of nausea kept him horizontal. He gazed around the room, feeling foggy and confused. He was on a steel gurney in a nondescript hospital room, probably Milden Public. Somewhere, a heart monitor chirped.
Beep, beep, beep.
There was a small window that gave a view of the clear June day. Sitting in a plastic chair by the window was a small figure. Backlit by the sun, the figure appeared in silhouette, silent, sullen, and still. So still, in fact, that Stan might have mistaken them for something carved from stone.
Lucy,
Stan whispered. His mouth was dry, and when he talked, he tasted blood.
Lucy, is that you?
The figure stood up and walked slowly toward him. As she stepped into the harsh yellow lights of the hospital room, and as the fog of confusion lifted, he saw that it was his wife. She took his hand. You're all right, she said. You've got cuts and bruises, some stitches on your right leg, and probably a concussion. But you're all right.
Lucy?
Joanne bowed her head, then shook it. 8 months passed. It was springtime in Milden, The cherry blossoms that lined Main Street were bursting with pink and white. Tourists were flocking to the Tulip Festival to see the flowers in bloom. The Madonna Fair in Kenny Park was in full swing, named after former mayor and civil rights activist Gloria Madonna, not the pop star. The town was full of color, but the big house on Mill Street was still gray. Since the accident, Stan and Joanne had hardly left the house. Lucy was dead, but they were the ones acting like ghosts. They haunted the same rooms in the same house each day, barely speaking to one another, together in their grief, alone in their sorrow. The house had been too big when there were three of them. Now that there were only two of them, it was absurd. The cavernous butler's pantry, the high-end appliances, the fridge that knew when they were running low on milk and eggs before they did. Lucy's room became a shrine, untouched since the day she died. Her bed was made, her stuffed animals stowed away in her toy chest. She'd been getting too old for them anyway. And all her books were stacked according to color in the shelf by the window. Everything was as she'd left it when she went off to school that morning. Joanne dragged all of Lucy's baby stuff up from the basement and left it scattered around the living room floor. There were clothes she'd grown out of, baby toys, the mobile with little glass birds that used to hang over her crib. The house had started to look like the back room of a museum, with relics and artifacts arranged in chaotic, unorganized piles, left to gather dust and stir nostalgia. Joanne claimed she was sorting everything, but all she ever did was walk from pile to pile, sifting through old stuff like a bird in a nest. Sometimes she'd cry, but most of the time she carried out this task with a sad sort of smile on her face. Those were dark days. It had been so long since anyone visited the house that when the doorbell rang on the evening of April 4th, 2012, it took Stan a few seconds to recognize the sound. When he answered the door, he found Joanne's sister Claire on the other side. She'd dropped by uninvited and unannounced with her husband Max, who was carrying an enormous tray of homemade lasagna. "How are you holding up?" she asked, pulling him in for a long hug.
"We're okay," Stan said.
Claire and Max were one of those forgettable couples you might talk to at a party one night and then never think of again. Claire was short, with soft round features and dark eyes. Max was an imposing 6 foot with broad shoulders and toned muscular arms.
"You're looking good, Stan," Max said.
What he meant was, "You're looking thin." Stan, who had once carried a bit of weight, didn't eat much anymore. The pounds had fallen off him. With his skinny face and unkempt hair, he was starting to look like a scarecrow.
"Thanks," Stan said, and tried to sound like he meant it.
Max and Stan had never really got along. They were just too different. Max would try to talk to Stan about baseball, which Stan knew nothing about, and Stan would try to talk to Max about books, which Max knew nothing about. It was harder since the accident. Grief is tough to be around. It wasn't just Max. Stan had lost a lot of friends.
"Are you going to invite us in?"
Claire asked. "Or do I need to knock you down?"
"Sorry, please, come on in."
Stan showed them into the kitchen. Claire took the lasagna from Max's arms and helped herself to the oven.
"Where's Joanne?"
"She's upstairs," Stan said. "I'll tell her you're here."
"I'll get her," Claire said, and slipped out of the room, leaving the two men alone to make awkward small talk.
"Drink?"
Stan asked.
"Got any beer?"
Stan checked the fridge. It was empty aside from some moldy vegetables and a few condiments.
"No, but I was about to pour myself a scotch."
"Scotch is fine," he said.
Stan poured them each a glass over ice. They sipped it quietly, willing the women to come back downstairs to break the silence. Max looked over Lucy's old things and said,
"Traffic was hell on the way here."
"Oh," Stan said, mostly because he couldn't think of anything else to say.
"There's been traffic jams in and out of town all week on account of the Tulip Festival. The I-5 is like a parking lot. I don't see what the big deal is myself. They're just flowers. We've got plenty in our own backyard."
He paused to sip his drink, then did his best to fill the silence.
Don't get me wrong, there are plenty of festivals I enjoy. Music festivals, film festivals, beer festivals.
As Max continued to list all the different kinds of festivals he enjoyed, Stan watched the stairs, willing the women to come back downstairs to save him. Eventually, they did. Claire prepared a simple salad to go with the lasagna. Stan and Max drank scotch with the meal. Joanne and Claire drank white wine.
We drove up to Henderson last weekend to visit your folks, Max said. Nothing's changed. Your dad's got gout again, although he calls it the gout, as if there's only one of them. Right, honey?
The gout, right, Claire echoed, smiling. And Mom has no sympathy for him. She blames it all on the scotch. Every time he starts complaining about the pain, she says, those who dance must pay the fiddler. To Stan, she added, that was her favorite expression growing up.
How's the old man? Stan asked.
Old man was a 15-year-old tabby, a gloriously fat cat that Lucy adored. On their trips up to Henderson, Lucy and old man could usually be found curled up together in a dusty old armchair by a picture window, bathing in the afternoon sun.
Old man is still running the house, Max said.
Claire looked over the table at Joanne and said, they feel bad for not visiting more. It's just tough with the long drive and all. Henderson was a long drive from Milden, but that had nothing to do with why they didn't visit. Earl and Norma had stopped seeing Stan as their son-in-law. Now he was the man who killed their only grandchild.
I need to tell you about something that happened to me, Claire said.
I'm not sure they want to hear about that, honey, Max said.
Ignoring him, Claire topped up her wine and said, last Tuesday, Max was out with his beer brewing buddies, so I was home alone. I was watching TV, drinking one or two of these. She paused to hold up her glass. When it was time to call it a night, I shut off the TV and went upstairs to bed, and just as I was reaching over to switch off the bedside lamp, I felt something. Joanne, who had been moving food around on her plate, looked up. She must have been listening after all. You could call it a presence, Claire said. I can't explain it much better than that. I was alone in that room, but I wasn't alone. Now, I can't quite say why I did this, but I felt compelled to pick up my bedside Bible and open it to a completely random passage on a completely random page. It was Romans 6:23. You know what that is? Stan shook his head. For the wages of death is sin. She hesitated, screwed up her brow. Help me out, Max. What was it?
Max was watching the ice melt in his glass of scotch.
For the wages of sin is death, he said, but the gift of God is eternal life.
Stan looked at Joanne. Her expression gave nothing away.
What are the odds of that? Claire said. I think Lucy was in the room that night. I think she was there to give me a little message.
Lucy didn't know the Bible by heart, Joanne said. I remember her thumbing through the Gideon in the hotel once, but it's not like she memorized passages.
Not in this life, Claire said matter-of-factly.
Up in heaven, who knows, but I think it was her. I think she was reminding us she's still around, not that any of us need reminding.
What do you mean by that? Joanne asked. Her tone was heavy. It felt like an accusation.
What do I mean by what?
Claire asked. You said we don't need reminding. What does that mean?
Well, I can still feel that little girl. Can't you?
I don't feel anything, Joanne said, and left the table.
Later that night, Stan was getting ready for bed when Joanne came into the bathroom to brush her teeth. Her hair was pulled back. Her eyes were heavy and dark.
Work called again today, she said, as she brushed and spat.
Did you tell them you're not ready to go back?
Yes.
What did they say?
What can they say?
Dave said to take as long as I needed, but they lost the Stedman trial and they need me if they're going to have a chance at appeal. They're getting impatient.
I can tell. Have you noticed that? People are already starting to wonder when we're going to get over it.
She gargled and spat.
Do you think my sister's crazy?
Stan sat down on the edge of the tub.
You mean all that stuff she said about the Bible?
She wasn't into that stuff when we were growing up, she said. She lost her virginity when she was 14, you know? But now, all of a sudden, it's God this and Jesus that. It's so irritating.
Maybe she's just trying to help,
he offered. Don't stick up for her.
I'm not.
And by the way, why would Lucy's ghost visit her and not us? He wanted to hug her, but Joanne didn't like being hugged when she was upset. She saw it as one more thing she had to give. So he stayed where he was on the edge of the tub and thought about what she'd said.
Maybe she did. Visit us, I mean.
Do you really believe that?
I don't know,
he said.
I don't think so.
That night, they made love for the last time. The sex was mechanical and detached, as functional as pumping gas or eating vegetables. Joanne was there physically, but her mind was somewhere else. It made Stan feel lonely. He wondered if it made her feel the same way. Afterwards, they lay together in the bed, neither of them touching. They stared at the darkness above the bed, not talking. It was too dark to see the ceiling, and for a while, Stan tricked his brain into thinking it wasn't there, that he was looking into a deep black void instead.
For the wages of sin is death, he thought, but the gift of God is eternal life.
Joanne fished around for her phone on the side table. She opened it, glanced at the screen, and then sat up.
I'm going out for a while.
Now?
Stan asked.
It's the middle of the night.
He turned to face her. In the low light, he could only make out her silhouette, black on a field of black. He thought about the day in the hospital, the still stone figure sitting by the window. She flicked on the bedside lamp and started to dress.
I'll be gone a while, I think, so don't wait up.
Where are you going?
Just out.
He sat up in the bed, feeling cold above the covers.
Joanne, what's going on?
He must have sounded pitifully eager because she fixed him with a long, sad gaze, then sat down on the other side of the bed.
Sometimes it's hard to be in this house without her, she said.
I'm sorry. I know what happened isn't your fault.
Stop doing that, he said. Stop telling me what you think I want to hear. Stop saying the right things, Joe, and just tell me how you feel.
How honest do you want me to be?
It was a strange question. Nobody had ever asked him that before.
Just tell me the truth, he said.
She took a slow, steady breath, then said, I shouldn't have let you drive. With your condition, I should never have let her in a car with you.
Joe, I hadn't had a seizure in years, and
it doesn't matter, Stan, she said. I'll never forgive myself, and
you'll never forgive me.
He finished for her. Without a word, she stood up and started toward the door.
Are you leaving me?
He asked. I'm not leaving you, she said. I'm just leaving. Stan woke at 6 the next morning. The space beside him in bed was still empty. Joanne hadn't taken anything with her. Her clothes were still in the walk-in, her makeup and toiletries in the bathroom. The only thing missing was her car. It would have been easy to pretend she'd just stepped out for milk and bread, but even then, he had a strong sense she wasn't coming back. He made coffee, mostly on instinct, then drifted around the house from one empty room to the next, drinking it and wondering how much space to give his wife. He stopped by Lucy's room. It was, as it always was, frozen in time. But today there was something out of place. There was a small TEC turntable in the corner. Joanne must have dragged it in there. A record was loaded. Stan tilted his head to read the label. Donovan's Greatest Hits. Donovan was Joanne's favorite singer. She grew up listening to old records. When other girls her age were singing along to Janet Jackson and Mariah Carey, Joanne was listening to the Beatles, the Mamas and the Papas, Cat Stevens, and of course, Donovan. He switched on the TAC, lifted the needle, and ding dong. Stan went downstairs to answer the door, pulling his dressing robe tight against his faded pajamas. He opened the door to a bulky, middle-aged woman with short blonde hair. She was dressed in a charcoal-colored pantsuit and a heavy parka. "Are you Stanley Weir?" the woman asked.
"Yes," he said.
She took a shiny gold badge from her parka and flashed it. "I'm Detective Engstrom with the Milden Police Department. Mind if I come in for a few minutes?"
"What's this about?"
"It's better if we talk in private." He showed her into the kitchen and offered her some coffee. She declined. "Is it just you in this house?" she asked.
"Me and my wife," Stan said. "It's too big for us, I know."
She gave a small shrug, then consulted her notepad. "Mr. Weir, does your wife drive a 2011 Mercedes-Benz C-Class in midnight blue?" He nodded, feeling nervous.
"Has something happened? Was Joanne in an accident?"
"Not exactly," she said. "Around 2 a.m. this morning, Milden police received a call from a truck driver. He was on an overnight haul traveling west over Prospect Bridge and spotted a car parked in the middle lane. The engine was still running, but it appeared abandoned." Prospect Bridge was a huge truss bridge that connected Milden and Reston. Below, alongside a deep shipping channel, was an extensive rail yard. Endless coal trains passed beneath the bridge during the night, carrying loads from mines in Montana and Wyoming. Engstrom looked at him sadly. "We searched beneath the bridge, and in the early hours, or this morning,
no.
The body of a woman was discovered in the rail yard."
"This is a mistake."
"No personal effects were found on the deceased, but the car is registered in your wife's name."
"Are you sure it's her?"
"You'll need to come with me to make a formal identification," she said. "But it's her, Mr. Weir. I'm sorry." Joanne Weir's body was taken from the rail yards and transported to Milden Mercy Public Hospital. We're in room 228 of the maternity ward. A woman named Marcy Keefe was giving birth. Chapter 2. Marcy. Fuck! Marcy Keefe bit down hard on her lip, shuddering through her latest contraction. She had never experienced pain like this. She felt stretched out and torn up, pulled open and packed to bursting point. For the first time, she was aware of her internal organs as they squished and squirmed and caved to make way for the baby. When Marcy was 13 years old, she was hopping the neighbor's fence. She was running late for the school bus, and Mrs. Grainer's yard provided the perfect shortcut, and slipped. Her legs splayed outward like a pair of scissors, and she came down hard against a sharp wooden picket. She'd needed 17 stitches. Compared to childbirth, that was a cakewalk. None of this was beautiful. This wasn't a miracle. It was torture, pure and simple. Marcy just wanted the damn thing out of her. "Motherfuck!" she grunted. "You got this, girl," her mother told her. Barb Keefe was by her side, standing alongside the hospital bed, squeezing Marcy's hand and making breathing noises.
"I don't know if I can do this, Mom," Marcy said.
Barb swept Marcy's blonde, tangled, sweaty hair away from her face and looked her daughter in the eyes.
"I'm afraid you ain't got much choice now, sweetheart."
Barb Keefe was a big woman, and while Marcy would never admit this to her face, made her picture meat behind a deli counter, beefy cheeks, hot dog fingers, turkey neck. Barb must have left the house in a rush because she was still wearing her faded pajama bottoms and a t-shirt big enough to use as a tent.
"How much longer?" Marcy asked.
The midwife, a frustratingly calm woman with red and green highlights in her hair, gave a small shrug.
"It'll take as long as it takes, Marcy. But don't you worry, because when that baby arrives, you'll forget all about the pain."
"How does that help me now?"
Marcy said through gritted teeth. Marcy's mother laughed. She actually laughed. Marcy glared at her.
What could you possibly find funny right now? She asked.
Well, sweetheart, you kept me in labor for close to 31 hours, so I guess you could call this karma.
Marcy wanted to scream at her mother, but that moment, another contraction hit, sending out a shockwave of pure agony. She grunted through the pain. When she could speak again, she asked, "Has Jackson called?"
Her boyfriend had put this watermelon inside her on the night of their third date, so it was only fair he should be here to witness the horror show. But Jackson was out drinking with his buddies at the Mill Pond, Milden's loudest and dirtiest bar, and he wasn't picking up his phone. She wanted badly to shout expletives at Jackson right now, but she wanted more to hold his hand. She wanted him to tell her everything was going to be okay.
Barb checked Marcy's phone, then shook her head.
He hasn't called.
Can you try him again?
I've left him 6 voicemails, Marcy.
Please, Marcy said.
Barb nodded reluctantly, then stepped outside the curtain that the midwife had pulled shut around the bed. On the other side of the curtain, Marcy listened as her mother left her 7th voicemail.
It's Barb again, she said. The 21-year-old you knocked up is about to have your baby, Jackson, and she needs another hand to hold. Get your ass down to Milden Public as soon as you get this.
Barb stepped back through the curtain with a forced smile.
He's going to miss it, Marcy said.
Don't you worry about that right now, Barb told her. If he doesn't make it here on time, I'll give him a blow-by-blow account just as soon as you get this kid out.
She tugged the curtain shut behind her, but left a 6-inch gap. Through it, Marcy could see clear into the hallway outside the room. It was an average, nondescript hospital hallway. Harsh yellow lighting, white walls, a bank of vending machines, a hand sanitizing station, a drinking fountain. A gaggle of young interns strolled past, all dressed in matching blue scrubs, led by a bald doctor in a white coat. The one on the end, a kid who looked young enough for high school, glanced in as he passed. He caught Marcy's eye and grimaced. The next few hours dragged by in a throbbing, feverish blur. Highlights included intense waves of pain, hot flashes, wild nausea, and a violent loosening of the bowels. Finally, the midwife said, "She's coming," and Marcy started to push. Somewhere in the pain-filled haze that followed, Marcy glanced out through the gap in the curtain again, into the hallway beyond. This time, she saw 2 paramedics, a man and a woman. They were both ragged and red-eyed, laid in their shifts by the look of them. One of them was pushing a steel gurney with a squeaky wheel. On it, covered with a pink plastic sheet, was a dead body. Judging from the size, Marcy guessed it was a woman. The paramedic set the gurney against the wall and consulted a clipboard. The plastic sheet covering the corpse ended at the ankles. Poking out from beneath it were 2 small feet. One of the woman's shoes was missing.
"Are they just going to leave that out there?"
Barb said, following Marcy's line of sight.
"I ain't going to let a fresh corpse be the first thing my granddaughter sees."
Barb stepped through the curtain and started toward the paramedics, whipping the curtain shut behind her. The image of the body lingered, like closing your eyes against the midday sun.
"Push, Marcy," the midwife said. "Push, push."
"Mom!"
Marcy called. Her boyfriend was going to miss it, and now Barb was going to miss it too.
"Mom!"
But Barb didn't miss it. She returned just in time to see the baby emerge. It was a girl, screaming and perfect. Barb cut the cord. Jackson had missed the whole thing. Marcy held her new child tight in her arms and fell in love.
"Welcome to Earth, Aaron,"
she whispered, and gave her a kiss on her perfect little head.
"Aaron?"
Barb said.
"You're naming her after my mom?"
Smiling, Marcy nodded. Barb started to cry happy tears.
"Well, I would have preferred Barb, but Aaron is a close second."
The midwife was right. Now that the labor was over, Marcy forgot all about the pain. She forgot about the body in the hallway, too, for a while. 9 years passed.
I'd just as soon eat my own shit,
Patty Windler said, examining the food on her plate the way a child might a nest of spiders. It had once been steak and potatoes, but it had been food processed beyond recognition. It was a little after midday at Happy Home Retirement Village, the 60-room old folks' home that stood at the corner of Main and Sunset Street, like a 4-story monolith. Marcy was halfway through the lunch shift, dressed in her starchy work polo, 2 interlinking H's over the breast. The dining hall was stuffed with residents, but most of them were eating quietly or talking in hushed tones in small groups. Golden oldies played on an ancient sound system in the far corner of the room. Jerome Heifer, 90 years old and thin as a rake, sat in the wingback by the window, humming and swaying along. It reminded Marcy of her high school cafeteria. There were 2 long tables in the middle and a swinging door that gave way to an industrial kitchen. Residents could choose to eat from the buffet, which served such classics as tater tots, canned corn, fruit cups, and sloppy joes, or one of the 7 rotating specials. Monday was fish, Tuesday was pizza, Wednesday was cheesesteak, and so on. But Happy Home's more soft-toothed residents, like Patty Windler, were served food pureed into paste form. Somewhere in her 80s, Patty was a small woman who was getting smaller by the day. She had Parkinson's, which gave her dysphagia, which meant she had trouble swallowing. She nudged an orange mound of slush on her plate with her spoon and asked, "Were these carrots once upon a time?" "Only one way to find out," Marcy said.
"I'll write you into my will for a tater tot," she said.
"You could choke on it, Mrs. Windler."
"I can think of worse ways to die than by tater tot."
"Can I get you a cranberry juice?" Marcy asked. Patty waved her away.
"If I get thirsty, I'll just drink my potatoes."
Laughing, Marcy collected dirty plates from the next table. She was halfway to the kitchen when her hip pocket began to vibrate. The rule at Happy Home was that all workers' phones were to live in their lockers, so she slipped it out discreetly to check the call display. It was Aaron's school. She set the dirty plates down quickly and ducked out into the hallway to take the call. "Hello, this is Marcy speaking," she said.
"Miss Keefe, this is Principal Birch from Brady Street Elementary. Do you have a few minutes to talk?"
"Is everything all right? Is it Aaron?"
"Aaron's fine, but—"
Birch left a 2-long pause hang between them before continuing.
"I've just had a chat with Aaron's teacher, and she brought something disturbing to my attention. I'd rather not go into it over the phone. Can you come in for a meeting?"
"When?"
"Today," he said.
"I work until 4.
"This is very important, Miss Keefe. Maybe I could call Aaron's father?"
Aaron scoffed.
"You could try."
Jackson wasn't around anymore. As it turned out, he wasn't drinking at the Mill Pond with his buddies the night Aaron was born. He was at his other girlfriend's apartment. He didn't have much interest in Aaron, and he had less interest in Marcy, so he split while their kid was still in diapers.
"I'm afraid this can't wait," Birch said.
"Fine, I'll figure something out and get